Hello and welcome back to another episode of Alec Mop, a hot mess with Matthew Dempsey, psychotherapist. I'm Alec Mop. I'm an actor, comedian. I live in Hollywood, and I just binge This Is Us yesterday all day.
Oh my God, it's one of my favorite shows. You just binged it. Okay, well, I'm Matthew Dempsey, huge This Is Us fan, and I'm a psychotherapist.
I just feel like the whole show is watching an entire life flash before your eyes.
It's many lives flashing before your eyes, yeah.
Yeah. It's like Einstein's theory of time, is that we're the only ones experiencing time linearly, but the universe, the reality is that it's all going on at once.
Well, I love it because I love how they're able to tie so many themes together through all of kind of jumping around through time, but you get to see this kind of like universal theme that comes together through family and through life experience. And that's what I love about it. It just seems as though that there's something for absolutely everybody to connect with and identify with that also then unites everybody, connects everybody. So I love
Do you ever watch the show and think, okay, if this was my life, what it would look like? Flashing back to me as a kid and then flashing back to me as an adult? Yes. I would be like, dude, wow, that is one fucked up person.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, actually, I mean, I kind of mentioned this to you right before we started recording the show today, too, is that there's something very I relate to this show kind of in some direct ways, because the kid, like the three kind of main kids of the show are kind of roughly my age. Mm-hmm. And also there's kind of like some similarities where, you know, my dad didn't die, but my parents split up when I was kind of young.
And your dad didn't die in a crockpot fire?
No. Spoiler. And but then my mom also wound up partnering up with somebody else, and that whole kind of dynamic of like a step family situation and kind of what that's like. So I really connect. I really, really connect.
You're saying that the dynamic of we have a guest today.
We do have a guest. Yeah. In case this wasn't obvious.
John Huertas, who is on the show. Yes. This Is Us. And yes. I've known him for a very, very long time. We haven't seen each other in ages. And see, the thing is, we used to cater waiter together in the 90s. And then I turned on This Is Us and I saw him the old age makeup.
Yeah.
Out of context. And I was like, Jesus, what the fuck happened to him? He looks terrible. We're the same age. Why does he look 60? And then I was like, oh, okay, back it up. So it's I watched the show and I was like, God, if that was me and you saw the pathology of why I am the way I am today.
Yes.
It would be really kind of like, you'd see that I learned things the hard way.
Well, what in
my life lessons?
Yeah, of course. What in the show, if anything, do you connect with? Like, was there something that reflected back to you some of your own shit or traumas or pathologies?
There's a dynamic between Mandy Moore and the kids in that favoring Randall affected Kevin adversely later on. Kevin for all intents and purposes should be the confident straight white guy, and he's a mess.
Yeah.
And Randall, because Mandy Moore deferred to him so much, is that the word? Kind of like, just kind of paid so much attention as a way of compensating, turns out to be the most successful, the most conscientious and everything. And I think that my thing is like, I'm just interested in watching the child parent dynamic, because my abandonment issues started so early as a queer kid. It's kind of like, oh, I got to pull it together.
Yeah.
I got to be perfect. I got to be extraordinary in order to make this relationship work, because this guy disapproves of me and makes it clear in no uncertain terms.
Yeah.
And then so in the flashbacks, you would see me as a little kid playing with a doll and getting yelled at and doing the correction. Flash forwards to me in my 20s, and I'm like a neurotic perfectionist. Like, what can I do or be to make you love me?
The overcompensation of just grasping for other people's attention or whatever to just finally feel like you matter, right? Especially because that felt like it was lacking.
It hurts.
I'm not so bad.
Yeah, I'm not so bad. Hurts.
Totally. Yeah. Well, I kind of love, you know, watching the show, and it's like, obviously the whole setup of it is that, you know, the father dies, you know, in this horrible fire when they're, you know, in high school, 15 or something like that. And there's so much where they're kind of trying to overcompensate themselves or grasp for attention, like throughout their lives, like even when it's so clear that somebody didn't intentionally leave their lives, there can still be this kind of like abandonment shit that comes up anyway, where it's where you're still trying to kind of like vie and grasp for positive attention and the you know, security that somebody's not going to leave you, like that kind of shit. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was kind of like my dad left when I was five. And so my mom was kind of, you know, really took up the majority of the responsibility. I don't remember a now they tell me about kind of whatever conversation happened and my dad sat me and my brother and sister down and told, I don't remember any of that stuff. I don't remember the early stuff, but I do remember kind of early on with them not being together anymore, having to go back and forth from one house to the other, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. But, the fact that I like lived with my mom, there was throughout my life, especially kind of getting into my teenage years, a lot of shit that comes up around, you know, oh, well, you know, you left our family. You didn't really care enough. You started another family. You got remarried. You had another child that became your focus. We felt just kind of secondary and kind of left out. All this stuff, right? Like all these stories that I had created about what it all meant. Right. And in a way that just can leave such kind of like this deep feeling of abandonment and fear that people aren't going to care. And like throughout my life, it continues to kind of play out. It's something I have to be really, really mindful of even today, because it's very easy for me to kind of like want to grasp for people's attention. And then at times kind of like stonewall and protect myself and hold myself back. It's kind of like all this defensive stuff because I'm just so scared about, you know, these things happening again or being left or unloved, that kind of shit.
I love how you said created the story.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of like that's what we do as children and adolescents, is we create the story of what this narrative means to me.
Yeah.
And but it's based on your feelings in the moment, and it might not necessarily be accurate because you don't have the perspectives of everybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, my mother died when I was like, I was barely 30. Mm. And it was so funny. It's kind of like I did for a long time feel like, you know, death is permanent. There's nothing personal about it. Nobody yes. goes, unless it's a suicide, nobody goes, you know.
Yeah.
But I did kind of for a while I felt abandoned.
Yeah.
It was kind of like, oh.
Do you remember like a conscious story that you did tell yourself or what you realize now was the story that you told yourself at that time?
I just remember, you know, I was going through a really difficult time. I was going through a Great Depression. I was going through a lot of financial hardship. I had just moved to Los Angeles. I couldn't get a job. And I just remember feeling like my mother was such a source of confidence for me.
Yeah.
My mother was like, she was always like, what's stopping you? Go ahead. You know, yeah. Give it a try.
Your cheerleader.
You know, she was a person who came from a great deprivation during a war, you know? So to her, it was like, I'd say yes to everything.
Mm-hmm.
And without her there, I had to kind of rebuild from the ground up on my own. And I remember resenting her not being there in a difficult time in my life. Wow. And feeling like, oh, God, this would be so much easier if she was here, and feeling really sad and feeling really abandoned.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Because what you're talking about is just the emotional part. There's nothing rational about it, right? Like you said, she passed away. That was not a choice, mm-hmm. you know, but the fact that there's this emotional stuff that gets stirred up for us, where it really feels like, wow, wasn't there anything else that you could have done to make yourself stick around? Or how could you leave me at a time that I needed you so much?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we kind of really get trapped or get caught up in this kind of conflict back and forth about what I feel versus what I know, and one has to win out. And so then when we default to, oh no, of course she didn't leave me on purpose, that wasn't intentional, in a way then that minimizes and invalidates how we feel about it. So we never actually allow ourselves to process that very normal grieving, you know, kind of moment.
Look at my jaw hanging.
I know. I see that.
What I feel versus what I know.
That's genius.
If you want to hear more nuggets of wisdom like Matthew Dempsey just dropped in our laps, download and subscribe to Alec Mappa Hot Mess with Matthew Dempsey, psychotherapist. These are the kind of gems that fall out of his mouth week after week after week. What I feel versus what I know. Because also as kids, we're not, you know, kids of divorce. My parents were married until my mother died. So that wasn't my experience. But there was a time in grade school where everybody's parents were getting divorced. And what I got from that is like seeing kids aren't in a place to process what their parents are going through. you don't have the empathy at age 7, 8, 9, 10 to kind of put yourself in your parents' shoes.
Yes.
In the mindset of an adult who is in a relationship they no longer want to be in.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, at a very early age, we haven't yet developed those kind of cognitive abilities to be able to process and understand a little bit more of what's going on, kind of more rationally, right? We don't have the ability to do that. And so what we do, because as children, we make everything about ourselves, right? For better or for worse, right? Mm-hmm. Like the whole world.
Yeah, I still haven't grown out of that.
But so when some of these more challenging or even traumatic experiences happen, we don't have the capacity to understand that it didn't have to do with us, that there are all other kinds of reasons why these kinds of things happen. And so what we do then is we personalize it. And then when mm-hmm. we personalize it and think, oh, okay, like for me, my dad left. Okay, obviously, well, what, why? Like, were we not enough? Like, am I not enough? Like, what's, how come, you know? Like, why wouldn't he want to work harder? It's not even necessarily a thing that I'm thinking consciously, but it's just the vibe, the feeling that I have, right? And then so mm-hmm. as a result, I learned. And I remember actually at certain times, kind of like in my teenage years, very consciously being like, I'm not going to talk to him. Like, he reached out to me. I'm not going to talk to him. Like, F that, you know? And,
you were in resentment.
I remember thinking like, this will be a punishment. And so it really was me kind of pulling back in a very defensive way, you know? And so
because
it's like, he hurt me. And then I tell myself these stories. He didn't care enough, you know, fuck him then. And so then I push him away. So instead of me feeling like I'm not enough, I then project out, point a finger at him and say, he's not enough, and push him away while I'm continuing to keep that same story alive within me. And then I replay that bullshit kind of narrative and psychodrama with other relationships that I've had in my life until I'm able to now, as an adult, reparent myself, give myself that love, check in with my story, rewrite that narrative, and then be more vulnerable in my relationship.
See, you'd be a really good episode of This Is Us. You'd be like, see, look at how much he's learned. People would watch my episode of This Is Us of my life and go, Jesus, this bitch hasn't learned a goddamn thing. Listen, I'm so excited about our guest today. Don Huertas from This Is Us. So we'll be right back with our very special guest.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
All right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
We are thrilled to talk to our guest today. You probably know him best for his role as Miguel on the hit show This Is Us, which I am obsessed with. And he just directed his first episode, which is really exciting.
He has been a successful actor for over 2 decades, starring in popular shows like Sabrina, the Teenage Witch, and Castle. He recently started a production company called West Side Stories, where he is passionate about telling stories people are afraid to tell and doing it with a comedic slant. He's also an old friend of mine. I'm so excited he's here. Please welcome John Huertas.
Yay.
Oh my God, John. Right before you came on the show, I was talking about how I hadn't seen you since we were cater waiters together. We ran an espresso cart and we used to do fancy parties together. And we would just,
that's right.
We would crack each other up so much. We would be laughing so hard. We were barely able to do the job.
Yeah, I think we didn't take each other seriously, that job seriously, I think, or anything seriously. So that's why we cracked each other up so much. It was, I have so many actually great memories from that. You remember the person who started the company was Arlene.
Arlene Golan, yeah.
Yeah. And she was super, very strict about that art. We had the big brass, like Italian decorative thing. And she was so particular.
It was about beautiful.
With that car. It was beautiful. And it was before the Starbucks explosion. It was way before there was a Starbucks on every street corner. And people would just line up for whatever we were serving at the most exclusive parties you've ever imagined. We did bar mitzvahs that, they spent, $500,000 on.
We did that one at the Sony lot, Matthew. We did a Christmas party at the Sony lot where they built an entire hill of snow for kids to slide down on sleds and everything. And I was terrible at making those coffees. If it's like everything was the same thing to me. If it was a latte or a cappuccino, you would get whatever I gave you.
And there's this amazing story from that time period that I tell people all the time. And, at one point I became like the liaison between the big catering companies and then the cart. So if Alec was the one trying to make a cappuccino and he was like, dude, I'm out of milk. And I'd be like, I'll be right back. And I don't, I'm wearing a black tie, white shirt, black jacket. I would run off and get milk and literally come back to the back entrance of the party. And all these big security guards would stop me. Excuse me, wait, what are you doing? Where are you going? And I would say, I'm with catering, ran out of milk, dude. And they would literally just wave me through. And I walked through one of those big exclusive parties and thought to myself, oh my God, I just basically walked into a party with 2 gallons of milk. And I had friends that were already kind of doing their thing in Hollywood. And they'd always ask me, hey, are you going to that party next Thursday? That big, whatever party. And I'd say, maybe, where is it again? And they'd say, they're taking over the entire pier in Santa Monica. I'm like, man, I'll see if I'm free. And I would literally put on that suit, go to Ralph's, buy 2 gallons of milk, walk into the back door and yell at the security guards and say, look, we're running out of milk. We got to get this into the kit. I'd set the milk down and walk in. All my friends back then would call me Rat Pack. I was the only young Hollywood person wearing a black tie with a jacket. And I would tell people that's just my style.
That's
Dean
genius.
Martin is my Dean Martin is my biggest, influence. My style.
And that's how you got into the Oscars. We're running out of milk. I gotta get milk to your speech. Needs your cappuccino.
Exactly. That was the biggest takeaway from that job. That and Alec Mappa's laughs and our friendship.
Oh my God. Aww. He used to do this face that just, you would say dude, but he would do it in a LA East Los Angeles accent. But then you would cross your eyes. You would just go, do, like forever. It was just,
really?
Do you remember that?
I see if I can remember it. Do. Hey, do. Is that one?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, do, check it. Hey, check it out.
Check it out, do. We would do that for hours, Matthew. It was awful. But that's how you get
through.
While
we were waiting for the rush.
Yeah.
That's how you get through a cater waitering job. Matthew, did you ever do a job like that?
I used to work at Barnes & Noble and I would have to work in the cafe sometimes. So yeah, I would pretend to make coffee drinks and not know what I was doing. Yeah, for sure.
So right before the break, Matthew and I were discussing our own abandonment issues. And I think that's the theme of today's show. Do you have any abandonment issues? Go.
Just dive right in. Yeah.
You talking to me or Matthew? yes, I would say that I do. I think the theme of society is abandonment issues. I think that, if we think about how we are just reared as children and how, mm-hmm. What our family dynamic is, if anything is any different from that familiar relationship there, I think there's always going to be abandonment issues because it goes against what our instincts are.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? If you look at our closest relatives, I like to consider the bonobo chimpanzee our closest relatives because they settle conflicts with second intercourse. The African chimpanzee, they have, this, how long they rear their children, how they carry them. And they carry them on their stomachs or on their backs. And, mm-hmm. I think that's there's something instinctual about us needing to be so close to our parents for a lot longer. We are reared a lot longer than a chimpanzee. rears its offspring. But if anything changes, I think that there's always going to be a hint, a sense, or, you know, a larger amount of abandonment felt by that child.
And so it's traumatic.
Yeah, it is traumatic. And so for me, yeah, I was a product of a pregnancy that was not, that didn't fit into the nuclear family model. Mm. And I was dropped off basically with grandparents. And, you know, my grandmother was an amazing parent for me, but everything that I'm bombarded with, and you know, Alec, you grew up at the same time as I did. I think Matthew, mm-hmm. you're a little younger, but you know, everything was about the nuclear family. Every television program you watched, I think when Alec and I were growing up is when they coined the term broken family. Your mm-hmm. family doesn't look like this, it's broken. Mm-hmm. I hate the broken family term. Yeah. I don't think we should use it anymore. I think mm-hmm. a family that changes is just a new dynamic of a,
exactly.
a family.
Exactly.
Type of family.
Yep. Right.
And so, you know, we grew up thinking we're in a broken family. We wonder why our mother doesn't want, I wondered why my mother didn't want me to live with her. Mm. And so, and especially when you have other kids that are also growing up in the same environment where the nuclear family is what the family is supposed to look like, they would see me and my situation and go, what's wrong with you? Why don't you live with your mom?
Right, right.
And I would get those questions. And as a kid, you don't have the answer for that, really.
Right.
Mm. And so, you know, I grew up, I feel like, you know, when you talk about This Is Us, our show, I'm more influenced and connected to Kevin's story than anyone's, because everything Kevin has done or does is for the attention of his mother.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that everything, the reason that Alec and I met each other was literally for the attention of my mother, because I'm an actor, because of that need see me. In school, I excelled in theater and sports, wherever I could be on a stage, wherever that could be focused on me. I think I would hope my mom would see me and mm-hmm. then say, come live with me. And, so I grew up with that and it, you know, it was tough. And there were moments, it was also, you know, I was a product of a biracial relationship. You know, I'm Afro-Latino. So, you know, my mom was Anglo, and at, you know, in the '70s, it was not prevalent, especially, you know, when I moved to Virginia, being biracial in Virginia, people just didn't understand what I was.
Yeah.
I would get kids walking up to me, black or white, cause it was only black and white, and some Vietnamese kids that were a product of, you know, Vietnam and having to leave there and immigrate to our country. I would have kids walk up to me like they just smelled a fart and ask me what I was. They would say,
Jesus, what are you?
And so imagine like seeing that face and asking, what are you? Like someone doesn't understand what you are.
Right.
So all of that compounded to me just trying to show people what I was. I'm a fucking amazing football player. I'm an amazing actor. I'm funny. I can fight. Like, I, you know, everything that I could do to excel at something.
Right.
To not only, you know, show people what I was, but to show my mom, look at who I am. Mm-hmm. Would you want me in your house?
Yeah.
And then, you know, it was tough. But then one day I, you know, things happened in my life. And one day when I got a little older, I finally asked my mom, why didn't you want me to live with you? Why could I never live with you? And, you know, over the years, I'd spent time with my mom, and my mom went through three marriages. Mm-hmm. And the second marriage, there were two kids that were born out of that second marriage. And, you know, a lot of holidays were spent with my mom, wherever she lived, with my grandparents. My mom would come over to my grandparents, you know, and, you know, celebrate Christmas, Thanksgiving, you know, all the holidays and, you know, all kinds of things. We would always see each other, but I never got to leave with her. I never got to be in her house. And so one day I said, Mom, why? And she looked at me and thrown off guard. She didn't expect that question. And she just thought for a second and blurted out, the life you had with your grandparents was way better than the life I could have ever given you.
Mm.
And then I started thinking back to all the times I visited her, wherever she was living. And sometimes she lived in some pretty shitty places, pretty shitty apartments where her second husband had two twin daughters from a previous marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember visiting once, I think it was in rural Pennsylvania, somewhere outside of Pittsburgh. And I remember like getting there and they showed me to where I was going to be sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one single bed. And that was the bedroom that the two twin daughters slept in, that single bed together.
Wow.
I was going to be sleeping in that same bed with those two twin daughters. And,
wow.
And I remember the place just having this feeling of like, you know, just, I don't know if squalor is the right word.
No, it sounds like squalor.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was like, you know, as a little kid, you don't really, you don't understand that. Especially I didn't come from any money.
How
really,
old so. Were you when she said that to you?
I was probably, I think, 15 and a half or 16.
Yeah. Was that the first time that you ever kind of like, because it sounds like, I mean, you remember it, but it's, did it give you, was it the start of an alternate perspective of your mother?
It was. Before that, I just didn't understand. I didn't know why she didn't want me. Right. And
what was the, sorry, I don't mean to cut you up. What was the story at that time? If you remember, even just kind of reflecting back on it, do you remember what you thought or what the story was that you told yourself before you even had more perspective later on?
So like I said earlier, I was the product of a biracial union. Mm-hmm. And when I'm living in Virginia, I'm living with my mom's parents. So the white side.
Okay.
I was called, you know, on the white side of my family, I had relatives that actually called me the N-word a couple of times, like repetitively, and other kids, other white kids, of course, the same thing. You know, I'm definitely a victim of racism and hate, and also that what are you thing. So there's a part of me that thought that that's how that whole side of my mom's family felt. What is he? And right. That my mom was afraid to have me in her life because of
the difference,
what I looked like.
Yeah.
And, totally. and trying to simplify her own life. And, you know, and I don't have any, anger really towards my mom or, you know, a sense of abandonment is different than anger. Mm-hmm. It can manifest into anger. Right. But,
right.
For me, I've always kind of had I love the word perspective, and I've always had like a really wide perspective since I can remember. And so I always feel like I kind of like float off the planet and I'm looking down on everything at once. And I know about my mom's story from my own like kind of childhood investigations, digging through my grandparents' shit in their basement. And I learn about, you know, what my mom went through growing up and what her story is. And if she never healed from that, 70s, 80s, mental health was not prevalent in society, especially in Virginia or North Carolina or rural Pittsburgh, wherever she was living. So she never addressed any of her issues, whether they be abandonment, betrayal, whatever it was. So can I blame her?
Right.
I don't, I'm saying I don't believe in good and evil. I don't think she was an evil person. I think, you know, everyone's a product of their, you know, environment, you know,
yeah.
The environmental that affects who you are. You have, you know, a product of abuse, a product of, you know, something that turns you into the type of mother you're going to be, or the type of person you're going to be as an adult.
Right.
And so I can't blame her and be angry with her. If I understand, if I use a wider perspective,
yeah.
If I understand that she's never healed from what she went through. And then
I'm curious, is that perspective, did you arrive at it? Because my thing with forgiving my father is kind of like, it really got to a point where this mode of thinking about the world and my parents is not working for me anymore. My therapist would say, you know, children don't have any choice but to take things personally.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very juvenile perspective. And I had to all of a sudden reframe everything so that I didn't take it personally. And that's how I could move on, because it was really holding me up as a person. So I'm curious to you, was this a gradual arrival at this perspective, or was it the work of, did you work on it like with a therapist?
So I didn't work, because I developed this perspective pretty young. And I think it's because, and this is what I worked on with any therapist that I've worked with since then, is that, you know, when I was a kid and you don't come from money, I mean, almost like less than, you know, just like lower middle class or, you know, barely middle class. When I lived with my white grandparents, but, you know, having a grandmother before that who had to work sometimes two jobs to make sure we had food in the cupboards and that the roof was over our heads. I wasn't having family dinners. I'm making my own food. I'm taking care of myself. In high school, I bought my own clothes. Mm. I got a job 15 and a half. So I already had to almost have responsibility like an adult does. I got to at my job at a certain time. I get a paycheck. I put it in the bank. I pay my car payment. I buy my own clothes. I buy my own food. I feed myself. So
what's that term for that, Matthew? It's not parentified. You're adultified, right? It's like Matthew, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. I don't know the answer.
I know that when there's like dysfunction in the family, that if you have a parent that you have to look after, the child becomes parentified. And right. It sounds like you were your own parent. You were kind of on your own from a young age.
Yeah. I think I like the term adultified better.
Yeah.
It kind of sounds a little more hip hop and street, mm-hmm. which I like.
Adultified. That was from Hamilton.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. But it's also, I think that, because I think parentified would mean that you have to, you're parenting your parent. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what my wife, that's what she always says she did with her mom.
Right.
So for me, it's adultified. I had to become an adult before mm-hmm. I was actually
survival.
Supposed to. Yeah. Or I didn't eat or, I never had to show a report card to a parent. I never, I never had to do any of that. So I feel like, my brain developed emotionally and, that idea of perspective developed before some kids do.
Yeah.
Because parents are parenting them for much longer.
Totally. Yeah. I'm really curious about that actually, because of your circumstances and probably just kind of how you are organically, there was this opportunity for you to have to really kind of be thrown into becoming an adult and really independent, right? And really have to just entirely rely on yourself, do all the things that you need to do. And that in a way can also kind of become almost like a new defense, right? Like, especially as we move through life, like I don't need anybody. Now I'm like almost like, counter-dependent, right? I'm counter-dependent. And so it kind of creates this conflict where I want to feel safe and secure, but I also have emotional needs to be met. And that kind of makes me think about a mm-hmm. thing that you just said a moment ago too, which is kind of like anger and blame, which are two very different things, because anger is the emotional part of it and blame mm-hmm. is the kind of thought process. So mm-hmm. I guess my question for you is, have you been able to arrive at a place, or maybe how have you been able to arrive at a place at your life now where you allow yourself to feel all the feelings, like maybe anger or some resentment or hurt or whatever it is, while also keeping in mind kind of what you know rationally that it never had to do with you?
Yeah. I mean, I think as long as I don't allow myself to blame, I think that's what keeps me. And for me to do that, seeing a therapist when I need to check in, I believe that mental health is as important as health. If we get
my God. Can you imagine if everybody in America had a therapist and like mental health was treated just as seriously as our lungs or our heart?
Or if mental health was in our curriculum, in our school systems, in the same way that physical education.
If we were taught emotional intelligence.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, I think that's super important. I also believe that, a lot of the things that we see when it comes to like, a student acting out at a school, whether it be a school shooting or any other way. And a lot of that comes from bullying and bullying that kid in particular. So imagine if at a young age, at 5 years old, it's just a part of your yearly checkup. You get your body checked, you get mm-hmm. your ears checked, you get your eyes checked, you get your teeth checked, and you get your mind checked. I mean, this has got to be as important as your ears or your teeth or your heart or lungs, right? So I feel like if it's normal, then kids would understand what mental health was. They would understand how important it is to their existence. Yes. So when you see a kid that is a little different from you and the other students, instead of bullying that kid, you go up to that kid and say, hey, are you okay? Are you cool?
Right. You push
like, what are you about? You ask them what they're about. So then you're learning about that person instead of bullying that person. Then that person doesn't take, years of just bullying and turn it into blame. Yeah. And then anger.
It's,
and then
the behavior is always the tip of the iceberg. I mean, as somebody, we adopted our son when he was 5 out of foster care.
And he's cute, so, by the way. I love that kid.
Trauma. I mean, the trauma of kids in foster care. They said, did you ever like lose your mom in a supermarket when you were a kid, and how terrifying that was, that happened to these kids for real. So when part of the reason we adopted him was not only we fell in love with him, but he was like a mollusk. He was attached to me at the hip wherever I went. Now he's like, fuck you, I'm 16, leave me alone. But at the beginning, we were always therapeutically informed about where he was. We worked with a therapist on the transition into our home. We worked with a therapist processing the type of family we were. And so he has a lot of emotional intelligence. So to him, being a therapist is like going to the dentist. I mean, it's just kind of like everything else.
Yeah. John, I was mentioning kind of at the start when Alec and I were chatting about it, about how I can, as self-aware as I am, and, you know, even doing the work that I do, I can still find in my life ways that my shit still does kind of get stirred up, right? Like, it's like not ever going to go away. We can just minimize it. And that impacts my relationships. In what ways does that, does your experience continue to show up?
Yeah, how does your shit still stink?
Yeah.
You know, I think it comes up, a lot of times it comes up with, I just think my mom's getting older. When she retired, I bought her a house, moved her to Florida, very close to my sister.
Wow, nice.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, I feel like even doing that was still a remnant of, look at me, look what I'm able to do.
You like me now?
Like trying to prove something or get the attention.
But, you know, but there were also, I just, you know, she had never really ever owned a house. So to me, it was important if I was able to own it, I want my mom to, you know, have a house. This is yours. There's not the lease doesn't run out.
Right. You know, home security.
No late rent payments. No, nothing. Yeah. Like, this is yours. And so, you know, to give her that gift because of understanding where she came from. But I think when it comes up now is when, you know, she's getting older and she's going to need long term care at some point in her life. And I've got this half brother and half sister that got the opportunity to live with her and grew up with her. And be parented by her, right? And they're younger, 8 and 13 years younger than me. And it comes up when discussing what's going to happen with mom when she gets older. Yeah. And there's a part of me, you know, there's a part of me that's like, bitch, I bought her a house with the dementia.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
You got her when you were a kid. I did. So then there's that thing where like, you know, my mom was my grandmother. I had to realize that once my mom told me the life she gave me was better than the one that I would have had with her. So by giving me to my grandparents, and I don't know if you remember, Matthew, the episode. So for This Is Us, I never cry. And when I watch the episodes,
I cry at everyone, by the way, every fucking one.
It's the music.
It's every single thing. It's like
has that 30-something score that travels through the entire episode. And like, I always wanted to do this version of This Is Us where people are having a conversation. They're like, where the fuck is that music coming from? And then the montage at the end is always meant to like rip your heart out.
Oh yeah. I was the writer and I, for this last episode that aired, we were very specific about the song at the end. She had written a song into the script that when the editor put it to edit, and when he and I were working on the edit, the song was like, didn't work completely. It was like, wow, we're not using that song. So then we started, you know, he put another song in, and I was like, the Bread song that if you guys watch it, you heard, it was so amazing. It fits so perfectly. And it's about like, the song is literally about a father and son in relation with the son. You know, the son only has what he has because of his father. So it's beautiful what the song is saying, even. And then there was some back and forth with, like, you know, the creator of the show, Dan Fogelman, was like, what about this John Lennon song? Put that in there and showed us a cut of that. And I was like, poo-poo. And get that Bread song back in here. So it was very specific about the music. And then Siddhartha, our composer, his music is just sick. And that's Dan's old college.
Yeah,
it's so good.
You were saying you never cry, and
I never cry. Yeah, I never cry. So in this one episode where Deja's mom makes a decision that her daughter's life will be much better in the Pearson house than in. So, you know, when I was watching that and my mom had already told me, she told me, I was just like,
yeah.
I made that face like Michael Pena did from Traffic.
Yeah. The silent sob.
Yeah.
Totally. Oh my God. It really does.
Yeah.
It really tugs on every heartstring. I have to say, I've got one comment about it. I have to tell you one thing. And then I also have a follow-up question about something you said earlier. The comment is, I have to just tell you, I would be remiss if I didn't say this to you, that the way that you play Miguel is so fucking perfect and spot on, because because that's basically kind of my stepdad. And it's just like the way that you play that character and the way that you do it with such kind of like grace to be there, to know that you were like not the dad, but like are there to step in and support, but you're also human. The way you ride that fine line is so fucking brilliant. It's so perfect. And that oftentimes stirs up a lot of stuff for me.
Thank you.
That's amazing.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, of course. And a question that I have for you actually is, it's interesting when you said earlier that the character that you relate to the most is Kevin, because in the show, there's been times when Miguel has really kind of butted heads with Kevin, right? Yeah. Because of this conflict, like, you're not my dad, that kind of shit, right? So it's in your process and in portraying that character now from like from a parent side, has that done anything for you personally and how you've been able to process your own experience identifying as kind of like
that's Kevin a great question.
Are you saying how it pertains to how I play Miguel, my own experience?
Kind of more like, because now you're forced to kind of play the character of like the parent to somebody that you've identified with. Did that give you a different perspective playing the parent?
I'm going to say not really.
I'm playing a father to a kid who has the same issues as I do. I feel nothing.
You know, it's like Kevin doesn't allow Miguel to, rarely allows Miguel to be a father figure. There's been a few moments, which I think, you know, for me, knowing how I would have liked to have been kind of spoken to by a father figure, which I never got.
Yeah.
I never really had a father figure. My grandfather worked so hard and the swing shift and the mid shift. So I didn't really get to see him except on weekends when he'd say, "Hey, let me relax. I can't really deal with you right now." So for me, I don't understand how to parent because I don't have kids. Mm. I really didn't. I feel like I was adultified really young.
Yeah.
So, in those moments when I've been able to, as Miguel, give Kevin advice, I guess I just imagined how I would have wanted to hear it said to me as a kid, and just the you know, the timbre of the voice that I would have liked, or a fatherly voice, you know, very measured way of speaking. And also I think you are onto something where, you know, because I connect to Kevin's character as on a personal level, like I understand what his character really wants.
Yeah.
He really wants his mother to accept him as much as he thinks that she accepts Randall and Kate.
Oh, the fight between Randall and Kevin at the end of season 4 in the finale. I was like yelling at the television screen, like, ooh, ooh.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
He said the worst thing that ever happened to me was when my dad died, but it was when he brought you home. I was just like, ooh.
Yeah, that's pretty mean, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was pretty mean. And then when he said your acting is just, it's a stale performance, like everything you do. It's just like every performance you give.
All low blows. Yeah, just coming from pain, so much pain and so much hurt.
Yeah, they just like, really hit each other. So
acting out. And I don't think those two characters still haven't really.
They have to make up before the season. So I'm so excited about you as a director.
Yeah.
Congratulations. That is major.
Yeah, that's great.
I would hate to be in a leadership position, and that's why I don't do it. I love acting because I love hanging out all day and gossiping. And as a director, you have to be on the set the whole time and you're in charge. How is that?
I like it. I don't like it because I'm in charge, because ultimately you're not in charge. That line producer that comes in.
But going, you are, man, in a leadership position. I know you are in a leadership position.
True. It's like, I feel like you're the helmsman. You're the person that the captain has said, steer the ship. Don't mm-hmm. crash into an iceberg. Mm-hmm. I've always been the type of guy that I don't like for anything to break and me not try to fix it. So if something mm-hmm. breaks, I take it apart. And I've always tinkered with things, have a mechanical mind. That's how I figured out how acting works, was very mechanically. And so I have this mechanical mind that thinks that I have the answer to how to fix little things. And so as a director, I figured out a long time ago while I was shadowing, when I started directing music videos and short films, things like that, that the director has to have an answer to every question. And there's going to be a question every 5 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what the leadership is. It's like, there are going to be questions from actors, from department heads, from people on the set. Everyone's going to have a question and you have to have an answer for it, or make them feel really comfortable in the moment and let them know I'll have an answer for you right away.
Yeah.
So to me, that's like fixing something.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. If the set is that thing that is not quite running smoothly or not working, I'm the guy who's going to take everything apart and fix it.
Yeah.
Think about all I'd be all like, listen, I'm exhausted. I need to take a nap. Leave me the fuck alone.
Yeah.
I don't want to be in that position. I don't want everybody coming to me with their shit.
Yeah.
Well, at the end, I felt that way. I mean, during the process, I just love it. But then once you do the full episode, in a television show is different than a film. You have, it's a tighter schedule. Episode was the fastest turnaround that we've ever done. I finished last Thursday filming and we aired it on Tuesday.
Oh, shit. My that God. Was like Ugly Betty.
Yeah.
We would like wrap and then it would be on the following week. And we were like, oh,
yeah,
shit, that was fast.
John, there's been a lot of questions, big question marks about like Miguel, right? Like he's not in the flash forwards. Like what's going on? There's also been a lot of speculation about speculation about like next season fleshing out a little bit more of the story between him and Rebecca. Like anything? Can you tell us anything? Like a little nod?
I can't tell you any story points that might be coming up, but there's been some seeds planted. we heard that maybe that Rebecca likes cocktails. We heard their wedding was in Puerto Rico. So we I think there have been little seeds planted that will be expanded on towards the end of this season and mostly season six, our last season. Speculatively. I think that, I think that you guys will get some cool
I think the show could go on forever because you keep flashing forward 20 years into the future. And it could just take place on another planet in season 8.
Well, it could go on forever, but they've said that they didn't want it to be that. They wanted it to be like a complete whole story that didn't start to get overdone.
And I think at least this version of it, I mean, personally, like my own personal kind of, speculation on how could this show go on? It's mm-hmm. introducing all of these younger actors, mm-hmm. all of the kids.
The three grown daughters.
If you took out mostly the Randall, the Kate, everybody, if you took most everybody out, then you have the whole new crop of 30 somethings that you could follow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just hope that I could be, the producing director on
it. Yeah. This is them. This is them. It's not us anymore. It's them. Listen, I'm so glad. I'm so glad to see you again. I want to talk to you forever and ever, but we've come to the end of our fine program.
Right.
If you've never listened before, please download and subscribe. We usually end the program
with
our guest telling a hot message of the day as it pertains to mental health or the subject at hand. Do you have a message to anybody out there, given your wealth of experience?
Well, my message would be, adopt mental health early as you can, because if we can all normalize what mental health is, then the stigma will be taken away. Yes. And when you tell someone, I'm going to see my therapist, people won't say, really, what's wrong?
Yeah. I know. That was my generation. It was indulgent. It was like, what's wrong? What are you going to see a therapist for? You're not crazy.
Yeah.
You have no idea.
So adopt it early. And I'm not just talking about like you for yourself, but adopted early as parents for your kids.
Yeah.
Just have them check in with someone once a year at least.
Yeah.
And then it, you know, we'll normalize it and maybe we'll be able to treat each other with kindness and compassion in the future much better than we do today.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see you. I'll have a shield on and a vaccination. Hopefully we'll work together soon. What lot are you guys on?
Paramount.
Okay. Hopefully I'll see you at Paramount.
Yeah. In the meantime, where can we find you on social media where everybody can see you?
Yes.
On that Instagrams, I'm at John Huertas, just my name. And same on Twitter, same on, I'm on the TikTok.
Oh my God. I'm not even on TikTok yet. Oh my God. Okay.
Yeah. You're younger than me. Come on. I'm on the TikTok. I haven't done like a ton of stuff on there, but I'm just not really as big on social media as I was. I was an early adopter of Twitter back in the day.
Yeah.
And, I'm not really on it as much anymore because, I'm super private. I try to keep my life pretty private. So,
yeah. You're a big time director now. You don't have time. You have a lot of questions to answer.
Have you seen Ken Olin's Twitter? That dude is, we have to yell at him when he's directing because he'll be by
stop tweeting
Video Village and he's just tweeting between setups. We're like, Ken, do you think I was any good in that last take?
It was great.
It was mostly Donald Trump hate. Like he absolutely.
Well, that was all of us for the last 4 years.
Yeah.
I love you, brother. It's so good seeing you. And I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Great to see you. And thank you, Matthew. It was nice to meet you, brother.
Thanks, Sean. Nice to meet you.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
Keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros, two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude, stop with the voice. Keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
Wow, Matthew.
Yeah, that was
another,
great.
Another terrific show for
so
people to download
great.
And subscribe.
Yes. Throw it in there.
I was supposed to add download and subscribe organically
everywhere.
Into the conversation.
Yeah, every 30 seconds.
As usual, I'm doing a terrible job. What is your hot message for the day?
My hot message is two things can be true at the same time. And I think that's a very important thing to remember, especially as it relates to us processing shit from when we were kids and the emotional, you know, traumas and issues that we've had to go through, because we process through that in a way where we can develop more of a rational, you know, a positive perspective on what happened to us,
uh-huh.
but not in a way that eliminates our feelings. It just helps us manage it. So we still might feel hurt and, you know, upset and angry.
Oh, that's really good. Because it doesn't make it go away. It doesn't. Yeah.
No. And we want to hold space for both of those. It's the yin and yang of life, you know? So we can have our feelings and also know, you know, kind of more of the positive.
Yeah. And to piggyback on that, because you're big.
I could carry you.
I know you can carry me. You can get hit by a car and get up and have lunch right after.
And then carry you, right?
just because I think a lot of people confuse forgiveness with when you forgive somebody, it doesn't mean what they did was okay.
Yeah, forgiveness is always going to be for us. And whenever we're forgiving, we want to make sure that we are forgiving the person, right? Because they're human and they're imperfect. Mm-hmm. We can still be really angry and upset about the things that happen. But, you know, we allow ourselves to forgive that actual person.
Right. And when you forgive somebody else genuinely, it releases you from the toxicity of that.
Yes.
It's really when you forgive somebody, it's really for your own well-being.
Yes. You know the quote, resentment is allowing somebody to live rent-free in your head.
Yes. It was like, or it's like drinking poison and expecting the other person to get sick.
Yeah. Look at us. We're a quote factory.
Wow. Where can people find you on your socials, big boy?
You can find me at MJ Dempsey Psych on Instagram and Twitter, and Matthew J. Dempsey Psychotherapy on Facebook.
And you could follow us both at Stage 29 Podcasts. Let us know what you're feeling, what you're thinking. We love hearing from you. You can find me at Alec Mappa on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Oh, it's so much fun talking about mental health. I feel so much better. Kind of. we'll see you next week for more Hot Mess Fun. Download and subscribe.
Bye, guys. This podcast has been produced by Stage 29 Productions for entertainment purposes only. The contents of this podcast does not constitute medical or professional advice, do not reflect the opinions of this company, any of its parent companies, affiliates, subsidiaries, promotional sponsors, or advertising agencies. The views expressed by the hosts and guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. For more information, please go to stage29.tv.